Welcome to the What's Next Sports podcast, where each week we will be taking a look back at the main headlines from the previous 7 days. We'll be offering you insights, opinion, hot takes and headline acts from the world of sport. You can follow the podcast on Instagram at whatsnext.pod and Twitter at whatsnextsport. Listen, feedback, enjoy and as always, trust the process.
It's just me and you for part one, Jimmy. Catch up with Tinners in part three. But firstly, how are you? Talk to me about your weekend and your return to the pubs.
What's there to say? The people aren't tuning in to hear about this, Andy. I'm still surprised that the people are tuning in at all, to be honest. Some weekend. Great to be back outdoors with everyone. What about you?
Well, it's the great outdoors, isn't it? Cold, but outdoors all the least. Have you got a dick of the week for us?
You know what? I've not even thought about that.
That's fair enough.
But I tell you what, look, you race through the headlines for this week. Give me 30 seconds to think of a dick of the week, and I'll come back to you because there's definitely one that's out there.
Okay. Well, don't shout it out until I'm finished.
No,
we'll do the headlines first. So, PSG and Chelsea are through to the Champions League semis. PSG and Bayern serving up a world-class two-leg cup tie. City and Liverpool both in position to join them, depending on how Madrid perform. Griezmann has his third child on the same day as his earlier two. All three born on April the 8th in 2016, 2019 and 2021, respectively. Dortmund left Mats Hummels and Köln when returning home from their Bundesliga fixture. He had to get a flight home by himself. Johnny Clayton and Jose de Souza hit 9 darters on back-to-back evenings in the Premier League. Marvin Vettori beat Kevin Holland in the UFC. Conor Benn beat Vargas to talk up an Amir Khan fight. And Savannah Marshall won to make the fight with Clarissa Shields an even greater reality. James Vince scored a daddy ton. Billy Root scored a ton off his brother. Ben Folk scored a ton. And there was a wicket-keeping cheating scandal, whilst county cricket in general had to battle the snow. The IPL is underway. Alfredo Morelos has signed for New York City, but not the Rangers one. El Buffalo is staying put at Ibrox for the moment. Logan Paul turned up at WrestleMania and ended up getting flattened. Rachel Blackmore became the first female to win the Grand National. Leicester breached COVID bubble rules and lost. Longstaff took a boot to the head and the Mags won. And Bielsa beat Pep. The 100 are going to call wickets out. And lastly, the Toon fans respond to Rio Ferdinand with a massive two fingers by setting up a pledge to try and buy a stake in the club. Any of those to touch on or a dick of the week for us, Jimmy?
Lots to touch on there. Rachel Blackmore winning myself quite a bit of money at the weekend. Long may her great form continue. Mags winning makes any weekend a lot better. Still on a little bit of a high right now. It's Wednesday. Can look forward to the rest of the week before they come and brew in next weekend on Saturday. And your last point there, Andy? Rio Ferdinand, dick of the week?
Yeah.
When is he not? I think that is a better question. Great to see the Newcastle United fans trust coming out with this pledge. I think it's a cracking idea. If it succeeds, fantastic. If there's any stake in the fans' voice in the club, I think that'd be brilliant. And if not, as they pointed out, any money donated will go to Northeast charities. And I think that in itself is a cause to donate for. So, can only be a positive thing.
They've had a lot of backing in a lot of the former players. Obviously, Warren Barton is involved. He's one of the guardians alongside Colkin and a couple of others figures. The idea, I guess, is to have a say in the club, and potential prospective future owners have said they would be open to that, which is arguably the main selling point. And I know that you are close with one or two people who are involved and have been involved in the setting up and the discussions of it. I've obviously seen it through social media. It's got a really good reaction early on. I do hope that, as you say, that caveat of if it's not possible to get to that £3 million mark for 1%, the money that is raised or the ongoing money that has continued to be raised going to Northeast charities, whether that's the food bank that the club have done an awful lot to support or surrounding areas, whatever causes they may well be, it will be really positive. And have you put money in? Are you going to put money in?
I will be putting money in. I've not done it yet. To be honest, I've just been too busy with pubs reopening and bars reopening to put money in just yet. But that will come shortly. As you said, I think fantastic cause. When you see people, legends like Alan Shearer and Warren Barton speaking out in support of it, it can only be a good thing. I think obviously the idea of it is behind the German mould, where a lot of the clubs in Germany, the fans have got to have a stake in it. And then you look at someone like RB Leipzig that is ran like an English club is run, with external partnerships, cutting the fans out, they're detested across Germany. So I think it can only be a good thing. If they get 1% stake, brilliant. If they can get any more than that, even better. In an ideal world, it would be completely fan-run, and it would be down to the fans to decide what money coming in goes towards transfers and backing and all that. But, I mean, we've had 15 years of Mike Ashley. It hasn't worked. Anything's got to be better than this.
I would like to see what Rio Ferdinand decides to slate Newcastle about next. It was all about transfers. And if you want to buy the players, buy them yourself. If you want to buy the club, buy it yourself. And, well, we've done what he's asked. So let's see what challenge he lays down.
The man is a helmet. He will find something.
He will undoubtedly give us something. But we made some picks for the Masters last week. We went through your office sweepstake. Shall we talk about that a little bit? Shall we talk about the event and maybe how well or how poorly your picks went?
I'd rather not.
Who were you backing? Who did you go for?
Dick of the Week was a tough one there, just thinking about it. And before you mentioned Rio Ferdinand, I was leaning towards Justin Thomas, because I had Justin Thomas and a 9-1, 10 quid each way, top 11 places being paid out on Skybet. And I thought, happy days. Going into their third day, we are in the money. For him to absolutely butcher it. I don't know what he finished on that third round, but I saw he wasn't even in the top 20, and I got terrified to go and look at what his actual score was. So Justin Thomas was a contender for Dick of the Week, but I went for him. And then my other contender for Dick of the Week was myself for going for Brooks Koepka. I wasn't aware he had any operation 3 weeks ago. I thought he was an outside bet at 28-1. So...
How many?
I needed Rachel Blackmore to win it for me on Saturday. Let's put it that way.
Put her in the Masters and she'll win that as well. How many of Brooks's green reading techniques have you tried out on the golf course over the weekend?
I've been trying them out everywhere. I think it's the future.
He looks so awkward. I mean, maybe it's what I need to try, to be honest. My putting, my 3-putt bogeys from everywhere are an absolute shocker. But I get that's the one thing that I've seen at Augusta. I made this point in our group the other day. If you put me on the greens at Augusta, 30 foot from every single pin, I would not break par around there putting. Not a chance.
Some of those holes are absolutely ridiculous. I mean, watching it from tee to green, one of the most picturesque golf courses around, with the trees, the narrow fairways, some of the shot shapes that you got to hit to even just find a route into the green. And then that's half a story from there. Once you hit the green, as you said, we're taking 4 or 5 putts minimum to get it within 6 foot, to get it within that bin lid that we keep talking about at Northumberland.
There are a lot of differences between myself and a tour pro playing at Augusta.
Really?
The fact that I wouldn't break... Well, I think the backswing mainly, but other than that, it's similar. Siwoo Kim was 2-putting from the 15th hole out with a 3-wood at Augusta. And I, as I say, would not break par with my own putter that I've used for 10 years. So, I mean, the course it's phenomenal. I thought it was probably a little bit of a disappointing Masters as far as it goes. Not necessarily the winner. Hideki, I think what he will do for Japan, etc., is phenomenal. I hope that the game grows with the Olympics going there as well. It's nice timing. The picture of him in the airport sat in the departure lounge with his green jacket just hanging over the chair next to him, as if this is just another Sunday. Is world class, and I can't wait to see what's on his champions dinner menu. But no one really making a run. Shoffley getting close, having a chance to put pressure on, and then making a 6 on 16, just clubbing it into the water. That had real smacks of one of our games, coming to the ninth at close house and just not carrying the water and just having a bit of a splash, and they might as well have shaken hands there. But I don't know what I take. Dustin Johnson was a non-event. Ricky Fowler wasn't even there. Rory McIlroy, sorry, was a non-event. As you say, Brooks was a non-event. Spieth had a bit of a run and he finished up there. I think he was top three in the end, but wasn't really involved. I don't really know what the major takeaways are from those players, other than Japan's got its first major.
I think for a keen amateur golfer watching it, I took a lot away in the sense that watching... Spieth try and play his way out of the trees and take it as the next shot from further back than where he was. That's something I can relate to. As you said there, Schoeffler putting a couple in the drink. Doesn't matter how many times you've played that hole. If you know it's a 7-iron, you're still going to keep trying to pull an 8 just to look a little bit Billy Big Bollocks to your mates with maybe some big names on the car path driving past you to watch?
Well, as they said on commentary, it was adrenaline, wasn't it? It's all about adrenaline, and adrenaline adds 10% onto a club, but and then it goes in the water, so it means nothing. There were a couple of shanks on day one. Oh, that's always good. I love seeing professional shank. Yeah.
Did you see the one? Is it the which is the par three, the iconic par three at Amen? Is it Amen Corner and Igenia?
12.
Did you see the 12, large shank straight where he's laid up on that? Absolutely golden.
It goes further right. It's amazing. But safe play. It's the good miss.
I mean, I'm still putting it in the drink with my second. So that water's in front of you for a reason. It is there to put you off.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how I'd play. People talk about playing golf courses with grandstands around it. And I know at Augusta, there's not really grandstands because it's the patrons and it's hard enough anyway. But at Augusta, on that hole, I am taking two clubs more and I am taking a drop out of the bushes at the back.
Did you see someone use the bushes? I can't remember who it was.
No, Hideki did something on 13 where he came backwards out the bushes and then managed to make a four, I think, with a ridiculous chip. But I would be playing into those bushes all the time and I would just take the penalty shot, but not out the water. I couldn't bring myself to do that.
Someone has skull-fucked a club into the bushes, but it's rolled down the bank and onto the green. And that's the type of shot play that I can get behind. A knife 9-iron that goes about 190 yards further than you need to.
It's stroke, mate. What about your own golf, Jimmy? We're going to try and take on the course and take on a few people soon, which may be evidenced in video or audio form soon. How's your own golf, the return to golf the last couple of weeks?
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I think the important thing is to just not think too much about it. Couple of practice swings, make it look like you know what you're doing, but certainly don't tell anyone what the mental plan is when you stood over the ball, because whatever the outcome is, you've got to be happy with it.
Well, as a great man once said, if you don't execute what you're trying to do, but you come close, then you can't be disappointed. And hats off to Coldog for that advice that we carry through in all walks of life.
It lives with me on the golf course, especially. If I'm trying to play a draw and I pull a big hook out, I can't be disappointed with that.
Well, the golf is something that we could get to. But other than that, Jimmy, anything to add quickly before we move on?
Not so much, to be honest. Looking forward to a couple more rounds in the sun. Weather's starting to improve a little bit up here too. So, I mean, I'm sat looking out the window now and what a day it would be for 9 and a beer. But well, we could instead, Dortmund City. So a bit of Champions League football.
Perfect.
And then iron up my bets for the next major. I think I'll start doing that. Start getting the revision in.
See who's on the surgery table. And then...
Not falling for that one again, Brooks. You beard.
I've seen you coming.
Although, Andy, I believe you have got a headline for us this week. What is next?
I have. I caught up with GB weightlifter Jenny Tong. She has an incredible story going from being a young offender. She is representing GB coming from Spain. By way of Spain, she fell into weightlifting whilst at university. It's been her real avenue, as well as completing a law degree. She has an incredible story. She spoke brilliantly. Enjoy. Jenny, firstly, thank you so much for your time. And secondly, as always with everyone, how are you and how is this current lockdown treating you?
Do you know what? I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. Third lockdown has been tough. I'm on my own for this one. It's the first time I'm on my own. But I've been quite fortunate in that I've been quite busy. So keeping my head above the parapet.
Yeah, no, I think that is a good way to go. And it feels like it's just hitting a little bit harder this time, whether it's the weather, whether it's the restrictions, whatever it might be, it does seem to be a little bit tougher for everyone. So I'm glad to hear that things are going okay. How have you been filling that time? I know we've just been talking a little bit before we started, but how have you been filling that time and what's coming up to provide that focus for you at the moment?
So I've got the English Championships coming up next weekend. They are virtual. So it'll just be me lifting on my own, loading my own bar, battling the cold weather. So I've been trying to focus just on training, just turning up, doing what I can, keeping a positive mindset throughout the cold, bitter sessions, with hopefully, reap the rewards at the English.
No, I'm sure. Well, you were just saying before, as you mentioned there, it's virtual and bits and pieces. It's open so anyone can come and compete against yourself and test themselves against you, which
maybe leaves one or two things up for a question, but I'm sure you'll come through with flying colours. I'm sure that's what we're hoping for. But Jenny, there is so much more to you than just being a weightlifter, and that's almost the back end of your story, so to speak, as well as shaping who you are a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood, what it was like growing up for you and how you were a little bit as a youngster?
Yeah, so I grew up in the south of Spain. I had, on paper, I had a pretty ideal childhood. We had a lovely big house and a pool, and I lived in the middle of nowhere, and I'd spend hours just roaming, exploring, building dens, getting up to mischief. And it was brilliant. It meant that I had to think for myself. I had to be quite independent in, you know, my adventures, get myself out of a few sticky situations. But that very idealistic lifestyle for a child wasn't as ideal as a teenager. So as I grew up, I started running out of things to do, and I got lost. Well, I like to say I got lost, like emotionally, mentally. I would do things to fill my time that weren't necessarily productive. When I was younger, I loved sports. I just wanted to be good at everything. And I think this kind of, for me, is I think I've always been a feminist before I really knew what feminism was. So it didn't matter what sport it was, I just always wanted to beat the boys. I always wanted to beat the boys. I always wanted to be the fastest. I always wanted to be the strongest. I always had my hand up when it was like, can you carry something? Yeah, I can do it. But that wasn't really there for a teenager in the middle of rural Spain, especially a teenage girl. Those opportunities just didn't really exist. And it meant that I found myself just looking elsewhere, and that elsewhere was drugs. Unfortunately, quite young. I was quite young when I found drugs, and it spiraled to the point where I wasn't going to school. I was being kicked out of school. I was being threatened with being held back a year, because in Spain, the baccalaureate system, it can hold you back a year. I was being threatened with permanent expulsion, and had I been permanently excluded again in the middle of rural Spain, there was no other school, so there was no other option. And it really did snowball and got scary. Like, I look back on it now and my heart breaks for that young girl, because it could have ended up so bad. It could have been really tragic. I had so much light in my eyes as a little girl. And then I think back to my teenage years and how lost I was, and I just felt really empty. And there was a bit of, I guess, an epiphany moment when I finally, my mum basically kicked me out. She was like, I don't know what to do. But in the nicest possible way, she sent me back to England to live with my dad. And my dad's really strict English teacher. He was like the scary teacher of the school. So I got back to England, and my mum sat my dad down, sat me down, and basically told my dad who I really was. And in my dad's eyes, I was his little angel. I was, again, this bright, gregarious bundle of energy with stars in her eyes. And suddenly I wasn't. And I saw that light fade in his eyes. I just saw something change in the way that he looked at me, and it broke my heart. It devastated me, and I promised myself, I promised them, that I was going to do better, that I was going to do better for myself, do better for them, to show that all their hard work and all their love wasn't wasted. And I think I managed that.
Absolutely. At that time, I know, again, it's part of the story and we'll come to it, but weightlifting wasn't that thing that was going to make them proud initially, was it? What, at that stage, when you just got back to the UK, you just had those sit-down conversations with your mum and your dad, what was it that made you think, actually, now this is what I'm going to use as my avenue to turn things around, for lack of a better phrase?
Well, first of all, it was just my education. I'd been on the cusp of losing everything. I spent a year out of school, so I didn't do the traditional year nine. I wasn't, no school would have me in the UK in Hull. So I think it was the reality that I could leave with nothing. I could have wasted everything that was given to me for free, essentially, the opportunity for an education. So it started with me really believing that if I work hard enough, if I commit to this wholeheartedly, then I can do well in school. And if I do well in school, if I can do this and I can prove to myself that you can turn it around this far, then you can do anything. And that will inform every decision you make. It will set you up just in terms of your mindset and your attitude with approaching the future. So it started with just doing well in school. And doing well in school meant, and I loved performing as well, so doing well in school meant that I suddenly had a little bit more freedom, because I suddenly wasn't grounded all the time, or I wasn't running away. I used to run away and no one would see me for weeks. Suddenly I had a lot of time, and I used to sing and I used to perform, and I loved it. I always loved performing, and that was part of the problem when I was younger, is that I was performing in an environment where drugs were still part of my lifestyle. And so I remember one day thinking, God, you're going to end up like Amy Winehouse. Like, that's just going to be you, isn't it? That girl that stands on the stage swaying side to side. And I didn't fancy the look of it. So carried on performing throughout my GCSEs. And my mum, bless her, she really did believe in me more than anyone ever could believe in a person, and more than I will ever believe in myself. And she really believed that if I wanted to pursue performing, then I could, and that she would support me until it was the last thing she did, and it was. So she suggested applying to the Brit School, which is a performing arts school in London. Now, at the time, the idea of moving to London to any 16-year-old is, I would say, quite exciting. And it was. And the idea that I, like me, this person who a few years ago couldn't walk in a straight line, could possibly get the opportunity to go to a performing arts school that created people like Adele, like, that to me was insane. So I signed up. I was like, count me in. We can talk about this a little bit further. So my mum signed me up to go for an audition, and we went. She flew over from Spain, and I got in, and it was a shock to me. I didn't believe that I was going to get in, but my mum knew. She just knew, and she'd already started putting things in place, essentially, to make it possible for me to move to London. And she came with me as well for a short period of time. And that was great, because I was in this amazing new city at a fantastic college, having all these great experiences and being quite independent. But at the same time, I had the security and the comfort of my mum. And so I had this really good balance where I didn't then lose myself again in the same way that I could have possibly done, because I had this stable element of looking at my mum and remembering that promise that I'd made to her and to myself that I was going to be better. And it was just a really nice time.
Did you enjoy your time at the Brit School? And was that almost an opportunity to be not an alter ego, so to speak, but when you were performing, when you were up on that stage, or when you were in that environment and it was all about music and drama and dance and expressing yourself in a different light? So obviously, even by that young age, you had a story to tell and ways to express that. What was that like? And is that something that you can then carry forwards, and that mindset almost of being able to put things behind you, express yourself in different ways, do things differently now as a professional athlete?
Yeah, I think it was really, really good for me in terms of getting to know myself and realizing who I am, not just as a performer, but as a person, and how to differentiate those people. Not just being at the Brit School and in that it's a performing arts school, but being in London, I think, really can make a person. You've got to have a bit of a backbone. And I did, I think, I, not to sound cliche, but I did find myself. Because it was the first time that suddenly there wasn't really the peer pressure that you'd had in school, and you weren't looking around to see what other people were doing. You so focused on, I want to enjoy this and I want to make the most of this experience. So I came out of my experience at the Brit School a much more well-rounded person, just for having been in the environment of performers. I mean, performers can be quite airy-fairy and up in the clouds, but my life itself, the life that I lived alongside that, was still very grounded. And so, it just gave me a really good balance that going into weightlifting, I was already of the mindset of, if I just focus into this, it is also feeding me. If I give myself to it, it feeds me and it makes me more whole. It starts to build me more as a person. And I think that's kind of just been the motto of my life. Like, I just want to be better. Doesn't matter what in, doesn't matter if it's stronger or faster or smarter, but just those incremental 1%. And being in performing arts, where you are constantly comparing yourself to other people, because it's tough, it's competitive, but you do have to look intrinsically and look at yourself and be like, okay, how can I just keep growing? How can I keep being better? Keep being more noticed? Keep living? It was a fantastic experience, and I definitely think I've taken a lot of what I've learned into weightlifting.
Having, just quickly before we move on to weightlifting, having gone from being a young girl who had found distractions in rural Spain to being a slightly older girl in the bustling city of London, at that stage, was performing arts as a career the dream? Was that the sole focus at that time? And then I guess ultimately, how did you manage to avoid the distractions of that industry and of that world, which has got one or two cliques associated with it, to then become the athlete in weightlifting as you are now?
So I remember being 8 years old. I was in the car with my dad. We just pulled up outside the house, and Tony Blair was on the radio. We were listening to BBC Radio 4. Pretty sure he was talking about the Iraq War. And I remember being sat there listening and turning to my dad and saying, he's talking rubbish, blah, 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 blah. And my dad said that I didn't know what I was talking about. And I just had a bit of a back and forth with him. And it ended with me saying, one day I'm going to study politics and I'm going to prove you wrong. And I'm going to do the right thing, because this guy does not know what he's talking about. And so, in the back of my mind, even though I did always want to be a performer, I was always very realistic and very grounded in the notion that not everyone can make a living out of being a performer. It doesn't matter how good you are. It's sometimes about who you know, not what you know. And I didn't want to leave myself on the shelf, if that makes sense. So I always wanted to have a contingency plan. So while I was at the Brit School, I actually sat my government and politics A-level independently. I asked if I could sit the exam, if I paid for it. And they were really kind and offered to pay for it for me, so that I could then go to university and even still pursue performing arts if I wanted to. But just wanted to make sure I gave myself the opportunity to go to university to study something that wasn't performing arts, as to not close doors on myself. So I did. And then, I got into university. I did politics at university, and that's when I found weightlifting. And I only decided to try it because I wanted to get fit, quote unquote. I just wanted to do a sport. I figure university is the time when you should try new things, try a new sport, meet new people. And I thought, well, I could just do performing arts, but wouldn't it be great if I actually did something physical as well? And I just fell into weightlifting, and it somehow became my life.
When did you realise, or how quickly? Because you can fall into anything, or you can turn your hands to anything, but you won't always
have the success that you have had in weightlifting, holding national records, working through the age groups, future representative honours at major games, etc. When did you realise that actually you had a bit of a knack for weightlifting?
I think it was surprisingly early. The very few things that I've not been good at, but I've very, I'm the kind of a, like a jack of all trades. I can do a lot of things to a certain level and then I just drop off. And it was, I picked up weightlifting pretty quickly and it was a few months in when I think subconsciously just accepted that I would probably start to plateau now. And I didn't. And I started lifting more than the girls that had been there for a few years. And I started catching up to the guys. And suddenly I was like, actually, maybe this is the thing. Maybe this one thing is the one thing that I might actually be really good at, as opposed to slightly above average. So maybe just pursue it. Or I didn't, I don't think I ever really thought just pursue it. I thought commit to it, like just turn up. If you say you're going to do it, do it. Have a plan. Why do you want to turn up? And yeah, very quick. I think it was quite quickly that I realized, probably 5 to 6 months in. And I remember there's a girl called Freya who we used to lift in the 53 kilo class together. She is incredibly strong. She always has been an incredible athlete. And I went to my first competition to watch one of my friends, Beth, at about 3 or 4 months in. And Frey was there lifting insane weights. And I remember looking at her thinking, wow, like, this is what I'm up against if I really want to pursue this. And then a few months later, I think it was actually like a month later, I snatched only a few kilos less to what she snatched that day. And I think it must have been that, like around that moment where I was like, actually, maybe I can do this. And so I just chased her down.
Do you think in that instance then, and it's something that I guess gets discussed so often, I was reading something about it even just the other day in paper, but if you were able to quite quickly realise that you could lift those lifts, you were a couple of kilograms off people that had been doing it for years and then overtaking them. And then, as you say, catching up with the boys. Is that far more of a nature you were born with it than a nurture and you were sort of adapted to the environment type thing? Do you think you fit more into that category?
Difficult, because I would definitely say it's a nature and nurture situation for myself. Genetically, my dad's part Nigerian. And I've just always had big, big thighs. When I was younger, it was the trauma of my childhood, is having these big, what I used to refer to as meat shanks, and nothing to do with them. Like, I just didn't know what they were for, like why I would be endowed with these. But I did judo and I did BMX when I was younger. So I was putting them to good use to a certain extent. I didn't really understand that at the time. But it meant that I was good at judo and BMX because I was quite powerful for someone so small. And that gave me an advantage because I was quite small and, you know, very powerful, which meant that that's perfect for being put on a BMX or for throwing someone around on a mat. Then
what? Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, then you put that nurture argument in there and it's like, well, would I have actually been as good at weightlifting if I hadn't have done weightlifting and BMX, because I've had that exposure to power sports and I know how to switch on. I know how to get my body moving. Whereas if I'd have just done performing arts up until being 18, 19 and then done weightlifting, I think I'd have struggled to activate that fast twitch as easily as I probably did. I think there's a lot to be said for muscle memory in that respect.
There's an awful lot of sort of self-finding in there and figuring it out for yourself and almost in hindsight working out, oh, that's what that's why I was good at that, because I had the big powerful legs, etc. What's your support network like now in weightlifting as you continue on your journey and as you progress to the heights that you're at within the sport?
Support network wise, weird in that I think eclectically I would consider myself a bit of a lone wolf. As cliche as that sounds, only on the basis that I don't have a coach. I coach myself. And so that already is a large part of your support network that is removed. So beyond not having a coach, I am quite fortunate in that I have mentors, and that to me is a lot more valuable than having a coach. I've got two or three really good mentors who I can go to for advice around my training, around balancing things, just anything I might need really to support me, they are there for, and I'm incredibly grateful to have them. I've got my family who are great and they support me, but more importantly myself, like I am the core of my support network, and I'm the main person that I rely on.
Is there an intrinsic motivation to continue succeeding and doing what you do every day in training to achieve that success? Or is there still a feeling of owing and being accountable for other people? Not necessarily obviously a coach in this instance, not even necessarily the mentors or family or whoever it might be, but just how much of it is for you and how much of it is because you want to put right possibly what has happened beforehand?
I think I've done enough at this point to put right my wrongs. I think I've proven more than enough and more than enough times over to the doubters that I'm capable of working hard and I'm capable of achieving things, but I don't care about them anymore. I have no interest in appeasing anybody else or meeting anyone else's ideals of who I should be or what I should be achieving. It is all very much intrinsically for me. I do it for me. I don't go into a freezing cold gym touching an ice cold barbell in the middle of January, early Feb for anybody else other than myself. I strongly believe that motivation, it has to come from yourself. It has to come from within. And I think I'm very driven to make myself proud. And that, to me, isn't limited to accolades and clout. It is just knowing that I worked hard and that I did what I said I was going to do and that I turned up and I put in the work. And it doesn't matter to me about what I achieve or what I don't achieve. It's knowing that, you know, if I'm, not to be very morbid, but if I was on my deathbed and I'm looking back on my life, did I do enough to say that I'm proud of the journey that I took? And wherever life takes me, as long as you kind of grab it with two hands, then I'm all I'm focused on is giving myself the best opportunities and the best life.
Would you say you are as strong mentally as you are physically?
Probably stronger. I think physical strength is actually my limitation in weightlifting. Yeah.
I think your mental strength comes across in tons, to be honest, in terms of how you can put things in their place, be proactive, move forward, be honest with what has happened, accept it for what it is and moving forward. And I think that will stand you in incredible stead moving forward, which I'm sure you're well aware of. But I know we mentioned the English Championships coming up short term, as in very soon. What can we expect from Jenny Tong long term? What are the goals there?
Well, if you'd have asked me this back end of 2019, I could have given you a very clear picture of what my hopeful contingency plan looks like. At the moment, with the world being as it is, all I can hope for is just to get back to that competition platform in whatever whatever capacity, you know, whether that's nationally, internationally, whatever, just to be back on the competition platform would be brilliant. The English Championships are the main focus at the moment, again next weekend. Beyond that will be the British universities, which are online. Hopefully, I'm hoping, I've got my fingers and toes crossed, that the British Championships will be running in person. They'll be in Liverpool, I think June or July. And then beyond this year, with the World Universities having been cancelled, we'll be looking towards the European Seniors next year and the Commonwealth Games. There is the Commonwealth Championships, but I can't remember where they're being hosted, but it's not on this side of the world. So I don't know if they'll necessarily send a team out, especially with the COVID situation. Beyond 2022, I think we're looking towards Paris Olympics. But I guess you never know with weightlifting. We don't even know if it's going to be in there. So everything is so uncertain. And this is why I don't pin anything down specifically on accolades or achieving certain things, being certain places, because nothing is guaranteed. And you essentially set yourself up for failure if you spend so long with tunnel vision on this one thing. And I think 2020 has proven that in droves, that you can set your eyes on something and it'll be snatched away from you just as quickly and you'd be completely beyond your control. So with the weightlifting being in the Olympics, I don't want to set my heart and soul on going to an Olympic Games if it's not necessarily guaranteed that we're even going to be there. So I can hope and I can turn up every day and work hard so that it's possible should it happen, but I can't guarantee it. So you can only do what you can. I don't think I like to dream beyond what is possible right in front of me in the near future, because everything is just so uncertain.
No, I think that control the controllables, what you can, don't get ahead of yourself is sound advice, especially as you say, if 2020 and last year taught us anything, it's probably that. But I think either way, whatever happens, whatever is to come for Jenny Tong, it's incredibly inspiring, commendable. I wish you the very best of luck with whatever it might be. I look forward to seeing whether they're released publicly or not, the recording videos from you in your garage for the English Championships. I'm sure you'll do very well. And as we mentioned, anyone who tries their luck will get caught out eventually. So staying honest to yourself is the best policy. So thank you so much for your time. We look forward to catching up with you soon. Best of luck.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
Cheers.
Once again, a massive thanks to Jenny. I'm really enjoying speaking to these athletes from different sports that admittedly I know very little about. I'd be lying if I was a weightlifter. Anyone who's seen me knows fine well that I'm not a weightlifter, but listening to Jenny talk about her story going from being a young offender who's overcome some real adversity through her life and some troubles, as she openly admits, to becoming an Olympic elite level athlete as part of the GB team, the GB setup, winning the English Championship that she was talking about there, coaching herself, knowing how to listen and talk to herself and coach her own body. It's quite a fascinating insight. And the mindset that these professional athletes that we're getting the access to speak to at the moment is something else. But people are going to start thinking we've all fallen out. We're not doing anything together at the moment because of our busy lives. We're all in different places. I'm now back down south, as we've mentioned. But Tinners, you've joined me for our final third, I guess it is now. How are you, mate? How are things?
Good, mate. Good, thanks. Just good. Good to get out and have a couple of pre-season friendlies, even if one of them was snowed off and the other one had some snow involved in it. So it's always great to start the cricket season in a bit of snow and just get that out of the way. But no, all good, thanks. How are you? How was your weekend?
I'm not too bad. I mean, I was on the wrong end of a result on Saturday. We were comfortably second best in all aspects. Unfortunately, that was a cup game carried over from last year. But look, it was nice to be out, a little bit of normality. It was nice to be able to have a beer in, well, it wasn't really the sunshine, as you say, it was the snow. But it was nice to see a few people and play some cricket, I guess. And then obviously next week, the proper stuff starts. So So we'll get to that. But any of the headlines that we were talking about earlier on, did any of them catch your eye?
I think I can't go much further than the Liverpool one. Obviously, a disappointing result against Real Madrid last week. Looked disappointing against Villa at start. They did well to come back. Very impressed with Jota again. I think he's stepped up, and hopefully that will kind of give us a little bit of a momentum shift into the Real Madrid game. I've just seen that Ramos has tested positive for COVID as well. I know I don't think he was actually going to play anyway, but the kind of worries of what might be going through Real Madrid might just help us sneak a couple of goals. The away goal has given us some kind of advantage. I think that if we sneak one early, then by all means Real Madrid will be panicking a little bit, but it's more of a hope than anything else. I think there's now more chance of us qualifying through the Champions League, with it being a bit tighter and a couple of the big teams losing out some results in the last few weekends and us picking up some points. So yeah, that's the headline I'll pick up on, just because I've got all my fingers and toes crossed, looking forward to the game Wednesday night.
Do you think without the crowd, that's going to really hurt Liverpool tomorrow night, Wednesday night?
I think the European nights at Liverpool make a big difference when it's full. It's like that kind of thing, isn't it? You turn up and they'd be going absolutely berserk. You never walk alone. All of that kind of gets in, especially on a European night. I think it will affect them. It'll affect them tomorrow on the comeback kind of thing. But like I said, if they get one early goal, then I think that changes everything, because then they are literally one goal away from going through. And we know Real Madrid can be shaky. They've pulled it together a bit this year, but at the same time, we know we can do it. We just need the lads and Trent to not have an absolute shocker like he did over there, and I'm sure we'll be fine.
And then, do you think, in terms of obviously the Premier League and getting Champions League football action for next year, from six at the minute, can he pull enough points out to get there?
I think so. I think it's one of those ones where you're kind of looking at more hopeful than anything else. But if you turned around and said, which way do you think you're going to qualify through, winning the Champions League or qualify in the top four, I'd go top four. I think West Ham have been great this year. Lingardinho, what a player. I'd sign up for Liverpool tomorrow. I can see them slipping up in a couple of games for sure. I just don't think they'll pull through the whole way through, which means it's up to be Chelsea. And I think... Yeah, I just think we'll have it in the end. I don't know what will happen, but I think we'll sneak fourth. Also, Leicester struggling the last couple of weeks. A couple of things going on, a couple of parties. We know they don't end the season very well. So there's always a chance that Chelsea and Liverpool will qualify, and Leicester and West Ham drop out, which I think will be what the top four will finish. I don't think Leicester will qualify.
I think that's the last thing Leicester needed. I thought they were dead set for second, to be honest. I'm still not convinced United have played that well all year, which seems bizarre to say, when they could potentially just be within a couple of games of striking distance of the title by the end of it. But Leicester clearly not helping themselves with these COVID breaches. Madison isn't a player that you want to have missing. I know he's trying to get back fitness. He's trying to think about the Euros and things like that. But just that awareness. Perez is obviously playing a massive role for them at the moment through this year. To go to a party, whatever it is that you're doing. I know Roy Keane was making jokes saying they're watching League of Their Own in the hotel room and things like that. But they need them out on the pitch. They can't afford with their record.
I mean,
but
if Iheanacho hadn't been playing out of his skin the last few weeks, there'd be nowhere anywhere. You kind of got to pull that into it. I think it's silly from them, but from a Liverpool fan, I'm absolutely over the moon. Keep partying, lads, for me.
Well, we'll see what they do. But why don't we move on? Tinners, what's next?
I thought we'd stick with the snow and the cricket. It's not really a headline. It's more of a tweet from Glamorgan. There's snow good news here. Their tweet from Yorkshire, as they were 161-4. Bit of snow come down and they were done for the game. And obviously it was kind of forecast all over. We saw the videos of Durham training in the snow the week before, and I just thought we'd have a quick talk about some of the performances in the county championship before we kind of move on to the glitz and glam of the IPL and the 100 later on in the year for the podcast, obviously the IPL kicking off. But I just thought we'd pick a couple of players out. The first one I'd want to mention would be Bedlington from Durham, obviously us being Northern lads, 50-odd and then 180. I'd be devastated if I got declared on 180. That would be my first thing. I'd be saying to the new captain, Scott Bother, what are you doing? If it's going to be a draw, let us get a double turn and move on. Thanks for coming. But yeah, I think looking at Durham's team, they seem to have more of a balanced team this year. And they take on Notts, which I think are a pretty good outfit as well. It was quite good to see them get some big scores and be a competitive team again, because we've kind of lacked that the last couple of years, I think.
Yeah, I think One thing I will say that this year, whether it's because of the crowds and long may it continue, is similar to what Dan Ryan was saying about the netball last week in terms of making it accessible. There's streams all over the place now. Sky have a great product for the netball. It's on the YouTube. The county championship, I know, even lower down in cricket at the moment, things are being streamed on a Saturday. People can watch the cricket and it might be one fixed angle. It might be two cameras, depending on where you are. And I know it takes manpower, but was actually able to watch a little bit of what Durham were doing through the week. And admittedly, that was, I'll log on my phone, I'll click a tweet, I'll watch the live stream for 5 minutes here or there, and then I'll close it down and I'll come back to it. But being able to watch cricket and put a face and put some runs and put a talent next to a name that you see on a scorecard makes quite a big difference. And seeing Bellingham score runs, and I mean, I would be buzzing if I was averaging 230 odd after one game in April in the snow. But also being able to see, as you say, Borthwick back for Durham, his first game back as captain after a long time away. Seeing what someone like a Rushie's like, how he's bowling in April in the snow is not what I'd be desperate to face. But these sort of things, accessibility, but also to be able to jump out of the Durham game, to be able to go and jump into the Glamorgan game, as you've mentioned, to go and see Billy Root facing Joe Root to bring up his own hundreds, that sort of thing. It's got to stay accessible so that these players, I hope, are given the limelight that they deserve to put them into that bigger picture, whether that's national honours, whether that's 100 drafts, whether that's IPL auctions and bits and pieces, I don't know. But I hope that streaming stays there. But on Bellingham, it looks a more organised team. And I know a lot of people up in the Northeast, we hear lots of murmurs, we hear lots of moans, we see lots of tweets from various people about another local lad. Great to see another local lad giving a chance, this, that and the other. And I'll be the first person to say that you as a local lad should be playing in those teams or should have been given a chance. But I know that they've brought in the lad from Warwickshire, the lads from New Zealand have just passed their quarantine, so he's able to play. And Bellingham is obviously a South African first-class cricketer and that sort of thing. Do you reckon Durham have got it right or wrong in that sense? Or is ultimately winning too big a factor to really worry about being the people's club, etc.? And for the North with that hashtag where people jump on quite quickly with only a couple of local lads there.
I think you've got to build something before you can start generating the youth, don't you? That's the problem. You've got to have people in and around that want to play for the first team around good players. They are well known for developing their young players and them coming through. Admittedly, at the minute, they don't have an awful lot in the team. But by all means, there is a few in the wings that are local lads in the second team, which hopefully get a chance, and some of them have got a chance. Matty Potter's in the second team at the minute, but he got picked up in the 100, which he hadn't done the previous year, which is great for him. I think they've got to do well first, and then they've got to be able to blood the young lads in, haven't they? They can't just go, right, we're not doing very well, put all the young lads in, we'll keep doing badly until we bed them in. I think as a young lad, I would have preferred to go into a winning team and continue to win whilst developing, then go in rock bottom of the division with a load of other of my mates and be really bad, and then everyone tell us that we weren't good enough. That would be how I'd see it. I don't think they can do it for a long period of time. I think it's one of those things that they've got a nice settled team now. Does that stay for a couple of years? And then you're blooding the young lads in and you give them a right good go, not just a one-off game. You have to actually give them a role and do that. I think that's probably something that Durham have struggled with in the past. There's lads who have been released who you think, were they given a proper chance in a proper role? I don't know. We don't know that from the outside, but from the outside, it's looked like it's been a chance here, a chance there, and then they move on to someone else who's from London, who's been released from one of the big counties. And I think that's where people probably pick up on it a little bit and say, hold on a second, why is an ex player from Durham? You haven't given him a chance. And that's what we say. Obviously, we support Scott, and Scott's moved down to Leicester, and hopefully he does well, but he's one of the young lads that you would have hoped would have done really well for Durham in the future. It's hard to say whether they do it right or wrong until you give it a couple of seasons.
There's a couple of them, obviously, in that team from last week. I know, as you mentioned, there's Potsy was playing in the twos. I think Coggers was playing in the twos. He's obviously come back from Notts. There'll be a few other names that I missed off the top of my head. Wheelie's just signed down at Glamorgan. But in that Durham team, going through it as an 11 very quickly, it was Lees, who is obviously Yorkshire-based. Jones is Scottish, but I think Durham's his first county, and he's a talented batter. I know Carl spoke really highly of him and expects him to do really well, both internationally and in first-class games. Scott Borthwick is captain, obviously coming back to Durham, is a Durham lad, so I guess they get away with that one a little bit. Bellingham is South African, he's come across. Burnham has obviously come through the ranks. He's system Eckersley is Leicestershire. Poynter was young cricketers, I believe. He was down at Middlesex and he came back up. Koss is obviously South African, but has come across and he's Durham with his counties. Ben Rain was Durham, Leicestershire, Durham. Salisbury was down south somewhere, I believe. And then Rushy was obviously Durham, released and then back to Durham. And he's just taken 700 wickets, I believe. So there is a bit of a balance. I'm not sure it's quite as harsh as a lot of the critics and the keyboard warriors like to say, but
and some of them like your pointers and stuff, they've been here for a long time now. It's not like they signed them as 28-year-old pros. They signed them as quite young lads, and then they've given them a right good go. And arguably, Poynter would say Durham's home, and I'd happily argue mm-hmm. with them that it probably is for him because he's been here for a long time. Mm-hmm. So there is that case that you give someone a chance and they make it home up here. Bryden is from South Africa, but Durham is his home. I know for a fact he supports Liverpool, but I've never seen him shout more about Sunderland in the last 2 years. But again, he'd argue Durham's home. And again, would argue that it is. He's not a Durham-born bred lad, but you've got to say that we've got a small county and eventually it's about winning games, isn't it? You've got to win games with COVID, you've got to win games to get money, and that's what it is. And if you want the young lads to come through, you've got to have the facilities there. And to get those facilities, the first team have to win. So by all means, for a few years, do what you're doing.
A lad from Durham supporting Liverpool. That reminds me of someone, but I can't remember who. Anything else caught your eye from this week in the county championship? Who else wanted you want to talk about?
A couple of lads from Hampshire. Vince obviously absolutely blazed it all over. How much more does he have to do to get another sniff at the England job? Is it again one of those that I've just said about Durham, that England haven't quite given him a chance, haven't quite given him a role? Where does he fit in? Blah, 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 blah. And the other one as well, I just want to mention, I suppose we could talk about them both at the same time, was Liam Dawson. He battered up the order. He got a lovely 152 off 139 balls. He played a couple of tests. Harshly done by not playing, or is he a batter that bowls a bit? Or is it just a case of, do we just look at one player's innings and go, get him back in the team because Jimmy's best mate, Bess, hasn't performed?
It's a strange one with Dawson because he's played a couple of tests and he's played a couple of one-dayers, yet he's always the next man off the rank. Yet for whatever reason, when it comes to needing that next man, someone jumps ahead of him, whether that's Best jumps ahead of him, whether that's Leach jumps ahead of him, whether that's Parkinson jumps ahead of him, whether it's Verdi's jumped ahead of him in the pecking order for whatever reason. And I almost feel that's similar to Vince, and Vince would have played 10 to 15 tests now. And I don't think he'd had a test 100, but had scored a couple of 50s. And everyone says about James Vince, he looks wonderful for a 30, looks unfazed for a 30, and then just does something. And that's what he's probably got to do, is score not just hundreds in first class in April, but score massive double hundreds. And the next thing is to do that in winning causes and win games for Hampshire. And obviously having players like Dawson around them, I know they've got a big setup there. They've got great seamers. They've still got Kyle Abbott opening the bowling, things like that. They will have opportunities to win games where his runs will be in that winning cause. And that will only do his cause good for England. It's just where he fits in that team at the moment. And that goes for a couple of people and one or two other names that we might mention in a moment. But he is going to be your middle order batter. And therefore, is he coming up against either a Bairstow or an Ollie Pope for those middle runs? In which case, is he his favourite with the selectors? I don't know.
Well, his test record is 13 tests, 548 runs, batting average of 25, we'll say. Top score of 83. It's not, it doesn't stand out, but at the same time, he's been in and out. That can't be easy. Because clearly he's in that level where he's too good for county championship cricket because he's always scoring runs. He hasn't quite made it at test level, but arguably he's been against Root for that batting position and then Bairstow and now Stokes, because Stokes bats up the order now. But they keep dropping Bairstow and Vince. It's like, we'll just give one of them a go and we'll be happy about it. I'd rather see Vince play. But he's 30 now, and have they just moved on? Have they just gone, you know what, no more? But for me, he's a top player, but I just think they've moved on now.
And I think that's probably going to be the same for Dawson. I think in all formats for Dawson, similar to another young spinner who was at Hampshire for a while, Danny Briggs, and he was the next young English spinner for a long time. And then didn't quite get the opportunity, didn't quite make it, just sort of fell by the wayside, and then just has a decent county cricket career. Dawson will always have those England caps, will always have those England memories, will always have those World Cup credentials as well, because he was part of squads and parts of teams. Whether he gets another opportunity again, I don't really know, to be honest.
Yeah, very true. What about you? Anyone catch your eye over the week?
The one I've got to mention, just because I've banged on about him more than enough on this, is Ben Folkes. Scoring runs, keeping in a bobble hat, just doing everything right. Probably in a similar boat to what we're just saying about Vince. He's got to go and score runs. He has scored runs. Is it enough type thing? I still stand by the fact that if he plays for England, he's got to keep wicket as well. I think he is the most natural wicket keeper. He's the most natural gloveman. And therefore, they've got to make a choice on either Best or Butler to play as the batter, because I don't think they can both play as just pure batters in the red ball. So, look, the ECB will always say that classic cliche, go and score runs, knock the door down, whatever, however they want to phrase it. And both Vince and Folkes have done that in week one. Now they could go on a barren run until June. And obviously people say, well, they've only done it once type thing. If we're having the same conversation next week after they've both scored more runs, they're putting themselves in the picture to have a chance to open the test summer once that arrives. But look, I really like him. I will continue to fight his corner, because I think there is a real opportunity to have not just the best gloveman in the team. I think if he's scoring runs, he quickly gets valued as a batter as he deserves. I think a lot of people are quite quick to say, yeah, Folkes is just the best gloveman, but he's not going to score the runs at the test level. He scored runs when he went on that tour down under, not down under, to the subcontinent a couple of years ago. Scored 100 in Sri Lanka. He scored test runs. He's just been similarly in, then out. Give these guys a run. And whether that's in time for the Ashes, whether it's in time for the summer, I don't know. I do feel whatever team they pick in the summer, that's going to be their team for pretty much the next 6 months. And therefore, it's not going to be until about this time next year when they're out in the West Indies where some of these people have a chance to actually get those caps. And as you say, that might be too late for Vince. It might be too late for Folkes by that point.
Yeah, it's a good point. I just had a quick look there because Burns scored a few runs as well. I saw he didn't get any in the first knock, but he got 70-odd. It'll be interesting because I think you're right. I think whatever squad they pick will be what they stick with for a while, unless someone has a fantastic start of the season and they can't ignore them, which normally happens every year. Someone has a standout season at the start and scores millions, gets in the squad, doesn't play, then can't get a run or take a wicket for the rest of the season.
I tell you, I've scored some runs. There's another one that has played in the North East Premier League from his time up here, and that was Tom Westley. And he's obviously played some test cricket at the time. He was in and out of that. Was he in at batting three for a while when Root didn't want to do it, and he'd have played four or five tests and would have had a test 50. I don't think he got 100, but yeah. Another one, again, he's sort of been forgotten about a little bit. If he just scores runs, he's captaining down there at Essex at the minute. So you never know. There's so many good players in county cricket at the moment. That's just the batters we've talked about. Bowling wise, it probably wasn't the most conducive figures. I know there were a couple of fifers. That Hannon Dalby at Warwickshire took a five for who has Lewis Gregory at Somerset took a five for. Rhys Topley took a five for as well, I think. Not sure he's ever going to be a test bowler, to be honest with you, but no. Taking wickets only bodes well to playing white ball cricket as well, because it is transferable skills, obviously. It's a strange one, as you say. How much do runs of wickets in April count, because it's such a microclimate of cricket?
Yeah, I like to say, I always see you every year you see some lad go out and belt it, or some lad take a barrel full of wickets. They get picked in the England squad. They don't play for 6 weeks because they're running drinks on for the lads, and then they don't score a run or take a wicket for the rest of the season, and then you never hear about them again. Every year, they just need to give someone a go one day, and it'll just work. And it will just work. It'll just, all of a sudden, people will just score a barrel full, and that's what it is. If you think about the England squad, there hasn't been a shock pick for a while. Best is probably your shock pick. Every now and again, you see Australia pick a shock player. You see someone else pick a shock, and you think, no, who's this? And then they go out and belt it. Labuschagne, no one had a clue who he was. Now he's one of the best cricketers in the world just because they give him a go. Can England do that? Yeah, arguably probably not with the way our press go. But there you go.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And I think, obviously, this test summer is a big one. hopefully at some point crowds are allowed back in. And that may be a factor as well, as how can these guys who have been performing, obviously coming off a really tough series in India, how can they perform? You've got players in that side who, as you say, have carried drinks. Right, Chris Wokes has just been constantly in England teams, and you almost feel like you've seen him do so much because he's there all the time, but you've also not seen enough of him. He's one of those weird ones where you almost don't know what he brings to the table, yet you know how reliable he is at the same time. There's so many players are in such a limbo with that setup in England because they almost want to keep it so small with their circle, but almost want to cast the net so wide at the same time, and they just need to find that balance, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're spot on with that.
Anything else to touch on there from the county championships, do you reckon?
No, I'm sure we'll pick up on it again at some point. I'm sure we'll pick on the IPL. I just mentioned one thing. I saw Ben Stokes has brought his hand, so he's out of the rest of the IPL as well. Just a bit of cricket news as well. But yeah, it'll be interesting.
No, I think going on alongside, I know there's always IPL and Red Bull cricket comparisons drawn, and that may be a topic that we'd have to put more time aside for to discuss in further depth, maybe as we come into the test summer. But interesting, lots of cricket happening, obviously, both professionally and for ourselves, which is to look forward to and have a bit of a run around. And I'm sure one of us will be far more successful than the other, and it's not going to be me. But looking forward to watching a little bit of cricket, maybe from the striker's end would be nice, but we'll get there. Shall we close with a prediction for this week? And this is very much thinking off the top of my head. But this week, Ben Askren is obviously the UFC fighter. Ben Askren is fighting Jake Paul, not Logan Paul, who appeared at WrestleMania. He is fighting Jake Paul, who is now a 2-0, 3-0 professional boxer. It is a YouTuber fighting a UFC fighter in a boxing match. Why don't we go for a prediction for that? I'll not be watching it, but I will find out who wins. What do you reckon? Are you going YouTube or are you going fighting background?
I'm going fighting background. I did see a clip that Ben basically said, if you're a good boxer, you'll probably beat us. But I don't think he's a very good boxer, so I think I'll beat him. which was an interesting statement because he kind of gets himself out of both ways. But yeah, I'll be surprised if he beats him because surely he's being punched and kicked a lot harder than what Jake Paul's being punched or kicked. So when Jake punches him, he's going to be used to it. When he punches Jake, he ain't going to be used to it, surely. But then again, Jake Paul seems to do some random stuff, so we'll find out. What about you?
No, I completely agree. I think almost to save the legacy of sport in general, I hope that the fighter comes out on top. I've read a few bits and pieces saying that Ben Askren is not a fighter. He is a wrestler, and therefore, if he got Jake Paul to the ground, he wouldn't survive 30 seconds. And if he wears one in the face, but like you say, he's been in the UFC, he's been in Bellator for a long time, he's been in the ONE Championship. He must have been hit in the face at some point to know what it feels like. And yeah, I just think that he's going to be able to wear a couple. So I'm going to put Ben Askren is my pick as well, purely because I hope for fighting sports legacy. If a YouTuber comes in and beats a seasoned veteran, it's not a great look. But other than that, pal, anything to add?
No, it was good to see you for a pint last night. I'm sure we'll catch up as soon as you're back up here for some more cricket and a couple more pints.
We will be. I'll catch you over the weekend, pal.
See you later.
I'm the cat with the bass and drum going around like bum, bum, bum.